Good evening, and welcome once again to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We're happy to return to discuss landlord-tenant law, this being the fall installment for 2024. I'm the host of Your Legal Rights, Jeff Hayden. 20 years of job creation with but a minimal increase in housing and competition from short-term rentals led to increased pressures on housing costs. The state responded with a statewide rent control and other measures to try to stabilize the housing stock. Then emerged a controversial proposition, Proposition 33, which supporters say Proposition 33 will push back against corporate landlords. Opponents say it will roll back existing tenant protections and potentially disincentivize construction of new housing units. Just what is Prop 33? Is there still upward pressure on rental costs, or did the imposition of a statewide rent control calm the market? Can we build our way out of what is perceived as a housing crisis? Is lack of affordability the result of a lack of housing or other forces at play? Have landlord-tenant changes, have any landlord-tenant law changes gone into effect in recent months? As always, we want you, our most important guest, to join in the conversation, so give us a call. Our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, it's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free, 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. But do bear in mind that our attorney guests are here to educate and inform. They can't always provide you specific legal advice for specific cases they haven't seen, but they're here to help, to inform, to educate, sometimes to entertain, and to give you guidance as you try to sort your way through your legal situation with the legal principles we provide. And returning tonight, our guests are three of the Bay Area's top landlord-tenant attorneys. For some 20 years, San Francisco landlord-tenant attorney Jessica Chalik has been practicing representing clients in rent board actions, mediations, and court for her landlord-tenant issues. Jessica launched her practice to specialize in San Francisco residential evictions, vacancy agreements, and rent board petitions for tenants, landlords, master tenants, and subtenants. Joining us from San Mateo, attorney Paul Lee has over 20 years of real estate law experience and has been doing unlawful detainer litigation for a number of years, having litigated unlawful detainer actions throughout the Bay Area. And also joining from San Francisco, attorney Salvatore Timpano is considered one of the top attorneys in the Bay Area to practice in the area of landlord-tenant law, representing both landlords and tenants in the area of eviction. And with that, Paul, Sal, Jessica, welcome to Your Legal Rights.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure.
Thank you, Jeff.
I mentioned Proposition 33. This is not a show on Prop 33, but if anybody is familiar with it, can anybody say what we really know about it?
Well, in general, it would repeal a state law known as the Costa-Hawkins Rental Housing Act, which has been in place for a long time. That act prevents local governments from controlling rent on single-family homes or homes built after 1995, or in some cases earlier, and when the tenants move out. Basically, it's statewide vacancy decontrol. And if it passes, local governments can create whatever measures they want to limit around annual rent increases, and the state couldn't do anything about it.
So when the opponents go on television and talk about no more construction, what they're saying is that if passed, you don't have that window of 15 years, 10 years, whatever it may be, before they can attach rent control.
Right.
So for an I'm sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. In general, tenant advocates are supporting it, and in general, landlords are opposing it. You know, individuals may vary, of course.
So that probably answers the next question. But what groups that are now protected, if the ads are true, what groups that are now protected will likely have those protections rolled back?
If Prop 33 doesn't pass, Jeff, they're not going to lose. No protections will be lost, as far as I can tell. The proposition's a little confusing, and we're constantly talking about it in my office. And it's just some misleading stuff out there, but it doesn't look like any rights are going to be lost if it doesn't pass. Do you agree, Jessica?
If it fails, then everything stays the way that it is.
How about if it passes?
If it passes,
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
No, if it passes, I think tenants get more rights because local governments can now impose rental restrictions that didn't exist before. But I think that's the benefit for the tenants, is that more rights are created for them regarding rent control or rental ordinances. I don't think it doesn't take away the state rights in the sense that I think there's supposed to be a clause in there that states if there's more restrictive local ordinances, those rules shall apply instead of the state law.
The opponents have an ad in which they mentioned that special protections for veterans and for the elderly are going to go away. Is that accurate? Do you know?
I don't know that that's actually a fact. Of course, they want to put it in the worst conditions possible.
Do you think it will lead to a disincentive? Will it disincentivize building if it passes?
Well, the builders are saying that it will. They're saying it, so I tend to believe that it will, in part because they're saying that it will, that they're going to be disincentivized to build.
Well, I think that refers to the developers, not the actual people building things. I'm looking at, going back to Jeff's question on seniors and veterans, Prop 33 eliminating existing protections for them, it has been determined to be absolutely false by CalMatters. CalMatters is an independent newsroom, and they analyze California legislative actions.
Actually, just picking back on that, Jeff, CalMatters also states that the claim that veterans and seniors would be affected is false.
Right, right.
Go ahead, I'll let you finish.
No, go ahead, Jeff. You're going to ask a question?
Somewhat related, but we have a very interesting paradigm that's developed in California in that you don't have rent control the first however long it is, 10 years, 15 years. You also can't sue the developer or builder after 10 years. So what's emerged is a practice where the builders are building condominiums and renting them out for the first 10 years until they have greater protections from suits, and then they will sell them out. Does this put that whole idea in flux?
Well, that is going to depend on the on whatever your local rules are, because in San Francisco, there is it's written into the local rent ordinance that if the developer is still the landlord in renting out condos, then it is under both local rent control and eviction control.
From day one?
Yes. As long as the developer still owns the unit. Once the developer sells the unit, then, the new owner can do it, handle it how they want to handle it, and they're considered, an owner under the rent ordinance. If they wanted to rent out their unit, might be under local eviction control, but not rent control, because Costa Hawkins protects that.
Since we were last on the air, the legislative year had ended, And it looks like some interesting case law has come down. Who would like to tell me a little bit about some of the recent legislation that's been passed and may soon be going into effect?
I can talk a bit about recent legislation since I provided the information. Again, I follow a lot of what happens in the legislature. They have a two-year bill period, and their two-year legislature period just ended. So there was a big rush on bills in August and September. So AB 1893 passed, and that reins in the builder's remedy for cities who don't have an approved housing element. A housing element is about how much many units the city or county or whatever needs to build in the next X number of years. San Francisco has to build 82,000 units by, I think it's 2030 or something like that. And if the if a place does not have an approved housing element approved by the legislature, or the appropriate board, then the builder's remedy has been a very new but popular thing that basically says that all of the planning code and other kinds of things like that don't apply as much, and you know, builders can build whatever they want to build, basically. And AB 1893 restrains that a little bit. It doesn't allow the builders, the developers and builders to go nuts with that.
Is that proportionate to what's happening throughout the state? It seems to me that that would be, in essence, one new unit for every 10 people now living in the city. That seems to be a very large number.
Well, I don't know what all the calculations are, but every city and every county has, they're supposed to provide a housing element report to the government, the state government. That's part of one of the things with Huntington Beach is a chartered city, and they're claiming that because they have a charter, they don't have to do the housing element and they don't have to, you know, provide housing, you know, at all if they don't want to. They're very not in my backyard-ish about it. There's been a lawsuit about it. The state sued them.
So what other legislation is passed?
Okay, well, AB 2454 is the Safe Drinking Water Act. Next year, owners of domestic wells that serve rental properties, and they don't differentiate between residential and commercial. So if you're a owner of a domestic well that serves rental property, then this applies to you. There will be designated testing areas, and you are required to participate in the testing program and provide the test results to your tenants within 10 days of receipt. And if the water is unsafe, then you have to provide alternate drinking water, and you cannot pass on costs. So that is more likely going to be important in more rural areas than San Francisco or Los Angeles or the respective metropolitan areas, but it's still a thing that passed.
The last time we were here, we talked about an ordinance out of San Francisco that even for a cause eviction, for an at-fault eviction, it required a 10-day warning letter before you could do anything. That seemed to be new and going into effect. Has anything changed on that front?
Jeff, that's been struck down by the Division I Appellate Court. The 10-day warning letter is considered procedural and therefore stepping on the toes of state law. So at this point, the current decision by the Division I Appellate Court is that local governments cannot add time to eviction notices. And so that's the current state. That's a case that Jessica put in the chat. It's San Francisco Apartment Association versus City and County of San Francisco. And that just came out like in September of 2024, that decision. So that 10-day warning letter came into effect as a response to COVID evictions, to keep people in their homes despite, breaches of the, just cause to evict in San Francisco. And it's now been ruled unnecessary and also contrary to state law. It probably was considered an emergency measure at the time or treated as such, but we don't have the emergency now. And it's been decided that that's impermissibly entering the arena of state law and not allowed.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. What's the status of the landlord-tenant relationship? Am I still protected from eviction? Do I have to pay people to move? What if they're at fault? Are there limits to a security deposit? Is it retroactive? Tonight's guests, Paul Lee, Sal Timpano, and Jessica Chalek, are among the best landlord-tenant attorneys in the region. If you have questions for my guests, our phone number is 415-841-4134. Again, that's 415-841-4134. If you're outside of the San Francisco Bay Area, call us toll-free at 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-8255. And as always, you can call regarding any question on tonight's topic. You're not required to jump in at the same moment we may be in our conversation. In preparing for tonight, I received some correspondence from some folks who didn't want to be heard on the air, but they wanted a question or two asked. So I provided them all to you ahead of time so I could be a little more brief than the writer. But one of them involves somebody who does not live in San Francisco, who moved into a quadruplex, and he came to understand that one of the people that was living in one of the other units was occupied by someone who had lived there for a long time, kind of assumed a certain amount of control over the units, and the management company's acquiescing. There's cameras covering virtually every inch of common area. And he came to stay in the apartment. He hadn't moved in yet. Before he had moved all of his furniture and the like in, the person appears to have driven him out, did such vandalism as slashing the tires on his car, making the firearm alarm go off in the middle of the night, things of that nature. And he left and was told some interesting things by the property manager. One is, you signed a lease, we don't care. You have to pay us a flat fee to get out of your lease. And nevertheless, you are still liable until we find somebody else. This is someone who hadn't moved in yet. Nothing's been touched. Doesn't have to be cleaned. Doesn't have to be painted. Literally, nothing had been moved in. He was only there a couple days. And he wants to know if he can get out of his lease based on the conduct of another and the management company's failure to act to give him some level of protection.
Okay, was that's the whole thing, Jeff?
Well, there's more facts in what he sent, and I could answer some questions because what he said was very, very thorough in what he texted, but that's the gravamen of it.
Yeah. Well, up to this point, if there's been a breach of his lease by the landlord, then the lease is breached and he's out. But the landlord may not agree that there's been a breach of the lease. And if in fact there hasn't been, then the tenant doesn't have a basis for breaching the lease. I mean, if they've tried to get out of it, they're going to be breaching the lease. So they would need permission That's what I get out of it, that won't be able to get out of the lease unless they get permission of the landlord, or if the landlord's already breached the lease, you know, which maybe they have, by allowing the other tenant to put cameras all over the common areas.
Well, that's the crux of it, is did the landlord breach the lease by not protecting his ability to quietly enjoy the property because they're letting somebody else take over and decide where people can park, and if you don't comply, he slashes your tires. He's got cameras everywhere, setting off alarms in the middle of the night. At some point, has the landlord some responsibility to make things right, or have they breached the lease if they don't?
Based on that limited fact pattern, I think the landlord has, and you're preventing, you just mentioned it, quiet enjoyment. How can someone enjoy the property if the management company or the landlord is letting someone, another tenant, go run amok? I think that this tenant probably would have a good claim against the management company / landlord and should get a security deposit back.
What can he do right now to get this ironed out, to make sure that he's safe in leaving, because he clearly doesn't feel safe in staying?
Well, he would have to send a letter or an email or whatever is the usual way of corresponding with the, you know, communicating with the property management and landlord, letting them know that he's vacating the property and it's because of the other tenant's actions. You know, and what date that he's vacating. It seems that it might have been, someone help me with the correct legal term, but it might have been they didn't come to a meeting of minds on the property. The tenant thought that he was getting a property where he could, you know, be in his unit and not be harassed or spied on by other people, and that's not the case.
Be like a constructive eviction or breach of the.
Well, I think it's a failure of the contract itself. I don't know that they met all of the contract formation requirements because there was no meeting of the mind on what they were getting.
And by that, Jessica, you mean they didn't sign up to have their apartment managed by a roommate?
By a tenant in another unit, yeah, in the building.
Yeah.
I think there was some sort of failure of communication, if you will, between the property management and the tenant. And I think that you might have an argument that no contract even exists. And so everybody should, you know, go back to the position they were before the contract. He gets his money back, the landlord or property manager re-rents the unit to somebody else, and everybody moves on with their life.
That seems to be the best place to start. Start with that, and then the other argument is the one that Paul laid out, of a breach. So either no contract or a breach, I think they're not mutually exclusive. They're both good arguments. And from that limited fact pattern, I think you could draw both of those as,
potential bases of
action.
Yeah. And just for the listening audience, under California's law, if a contract is breached by one party, the other party has no duty to perform their part of the contract.
And in terms of communicating this to the property managers, they had suggested proceeding informally, just send us a text and let us know what day. And it sounds, from what you've advised, that he'd be much better suited by actually writing them a letter and memorializing exactly what's gone on and why he doesn't feel that there was a meeting of minds in the lease, or alternatively, or maybe both, why he feels like he's been pushed out by their inaction.
Right. If the usual method of communication is text, that is acceptable. Provided that the texts are kept, that, you know, it's clear from the text itself who the who is communicating, you know, if it's a phone number or something that's a, you know, ABC management company or, you know, Ted the manager or something like that, you know, and the dates of everything, that would be okay, because courts are accepting screenshots of text messages and that sort of stuff, as long as there's some identifying information that has the date and who it is that's communicating back and forth.
And of course, this, from his fact pattern, it sounded like this has all been within a couple of days. This all happened very, very fast.
Yeah. I'd probably follow up with an actual email or written letter.
Well, I hope that's been of some help to you. I know that you're listening out there. And thank you for sharing it with your legal rights. I did get another email that looks like it's of some interest. Caller received a 21-day threat that they will go to collections if they don't pay. This is after they've moved out. And the landlord wants to not only keep the deposit, but they want an additional amount on top of it for cleaning. The tenant cleaned the place to where it was, looked like it was a military barracks. It was absolutely spotless. They went over the carpet, hand cleaned it with baking soda and vinegar and the like. The landlords are trying to charge a cleaning fee without explaining their expenditures. Yeah. And they're including the damp carpet. They want to replace it, and it looks like a lot of money. What limits are there on the landlord in that case?
Reasonableness. It's all got to be reasonable. Landlord has to have receipts or documentation if they do the work. And it's got to be reasonable. It's got to be done within the statutory time frame limits. Right. And, you know, if the tenant's got pictures of the unit as they left it, then that would all be good evidence to argue for, you know, damages, which could include up to three times the amount of the security deposit itself.
The Code of Civil Procedure, Section 1950.5. Is that right?
Yeah. That's right, Jessica.
No, it's civil code. It's civil code 1950.5 is the security deposit law in California. And it lists specifically what you have to put in your accounting when you are not returning a security deposit. And you have to include receipts and estimates and that sort of thing. You know, and starting next year, you're going to have to take photos. It's going to be required for landlords to take photos right before a new tenant moves in after the cleaning's done, because there are a lot of these kinds of cases.
And I'm sorry, Paul, go ahead.
It's not the tenant's responsibility to put the unit back to a better condition either. So It sounds like this landlord just wants a better condition. Tenant's not required to put it in a better condition.
No.
See the problem.
It seems to me that some of this might be reasonable wear and tear also, for depending on how long the tenant has lived there.
Yeah, and that would be allowed and expected for the tenant's benefit. Reasonable wear and tear wouldn't be something that the landlord would be allowed to charge for. They charge $125 without receipts. You know, for cleaning, but other than that, everything's got to be documented, and regular wear and tear would not be a legal deduction.
Yeah.
You're listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area. We will be back right after this.
Support for KALW is provided by the Bar Association of San Francisco. If you live in San Francisco or Marin County, the Bar Association's Lawyer Referral Service can arrange for you to meet with an attorney experienced in the area of law related to your situation. Call 415-989-1616. That's 415-989-1616. Or visit sfbar.org for more information.
You know, we were talking about legislation, and the big sea change seems to have been with the Tenant Protection Act of 2019. Have there been any amendments to that of late?
Not specifically to the Tenant Protection Act of 2019. There is a effective April 1, 2025, AB 2747 goes into effect. That's where landlords with more than 15 units have to offer a credit reporting option to new tenants when signing a lease and to current tenants by April 1st. This offer, that, you know, and then it has to be offered once a year after. There's more that goes with it, but that's so that, like, you can get credit for paying your rent regularly. That's one thing that renters and home buyers are. I've been paying a $2,000 rent with no problem, and they won't let me have a, you know, $1,500 a month mortgage or whatever.
There's been some additions regarding no fault, just cause evictions, though.
Yes.
Jessica, I think you probably know more than I do about that. So,
Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, for example, if before a landlord could give a notice because they were going to do some substantial remodeling, or they were going to have a relative move in. And originally the statute was pretty vague as to what that meant, but now, for example, substantial remodeling, the landlord has to provide permits, contracts, you know, to actually show that he's going to do the work instead of just this just being a pretext of trying to remove a tenant. Regarding the relative moving in, there's all sorts of new requirements regarding who the relative is, how long they're going to be there. It's just, there's more meat to it in the sense that landlords have to provide more evidence that they're going to do certain things to do a no-fault eviction.
Right. And that's because, you know, the legislature doesn't make rules unless there have been abuses, in my opinion, in my opinion. So I think there's been some complaints about folks doing just that, saying they're going to do a owner or relative move in, get the tenants out, and then not go through with it or not go through with whatever rehabilitation they were planning.
I've had a few people call me wanting to try to do that, and I said, no, you can't do that.
One of the things that seems to have changed of late is the whole idea of deposits. People didn't always understand that whatever deposits you pay are all called security under the law. So whether it's your first month and last, whether it's last month's rent or your security deposit, like, it's all security and all lumped together. But it seems that this has been drastically limited in the last year.
Yeah, right. It has, right? It's now one month's rent. Is that
right? Instead of it was that you could charge 2 months rent for an unfurnished unit and 3 months rent for a furnished unit, but that was all scaled back to only 1 month's rent for any unit in the middle of 2024, I believe. I think that was effective July 1st.
What about a pet deposit? Is that still part and parcel of the same deposit?
Yes, I believe it is.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be cumulative, so you can't separate. Pet deposit is X amount of dollars. Security deposit is X amount of dollars. It's just one lump sum from what I gather.
Yeah, it's not spelled out in the statute, is it? Do you see it spelled out, Paul or Jessica? I didn't see it spelled out in there. I don't recall. I don't know, but it seems to me that it makes sense that it's probably one deposit for the whole thing.
Right. I think the exception is something like a key deposit or, an electronic device for entering a unit. If there's a deposit for the security and return of that, I think that is not included in a security deposit, but I could be wrong.
Yeah. I haven't read the legislative intent on that one to see if the pet deposit is part of it or not, but I think what they're trying to do is make it easier for tenants to rent units. So it would just seem to be reasonable to assume that the pet deposit would be part of it as well.
Right. Well, you know, because so many metropolitan areas have such high rents in California, it's very hard for anybody who's working a retail job or some other job that, you know, isn't paying over six figures to collect more than one month's rent put down as a deposit. You know, I mean,
yeah.
What did we used to tell people? You needed to have the first month's rent, the security deposit, and, you know, whatever else it was. Sometimes it was two or three months of money just to move in, and not including moving costs and changing your utilities and all of that stuff. So the intent was to help that out by taking it down to 1 month's rent as a security deposit, and that being pretty inclusive of all monies.
I mean, what that means for landlords is more than just how much security they have. But before, a landlord could wait to serve a 3-day notice and still have maybe up to 3 months of rent in the form of a security. Now they've got 1 month's rent, and when they're having problems, they got to pull the trigger quick on serving the 3-day notice because they don't have any security that could otherwise be used to pay unpaid rent during the pendency of that eviction notice and the lawsuit. But now they've only got one month. So, you know, the advice to landlords would be, if you're going to serve an eviction notice, don't wait. Serve it right away. Especially now that you don't have to give a 10-day notice. Just get that eviction notice out the door right away and ask questions later, you know, but don't.
But make sure you get one that complies with the law. I mean, you don't want to just write, you got to get out by the end of the month and, you know, give them an email that says that is not going to fly with the courts.
That's not an eviction notice. It's a communication at best.
And even whether landlord or tenant, even if you're using approved forms like they used to sell in stationery stores, it better be current because a lot has changed in recent years.
That's absolutely right.
For sure. And then a lot of those that were sold in the stationery stores, maybe they still are, they were drafted for particular jurisdictions, not all California jurisdictions. So even if they were up to date, they could be wrong for your particular jurisdiction. So they were probably never really a good idea. I mean, it was hit or miss whether it was going to work. And it might have worked in a totally non-rent controlled jurisdiction because they were pretty much modeled on state law. The local jurisdictions are complicated. You just got to get involved with them. And if you're not, you're just not going to be able to rely on state law to, you know, either for the eviction or even for the defenses to the eviction. You need the local rules.
Right.
So, yeah, that stationary stuff was strange. That really was strange.
Even, you know, if you go online now and you find something that says California lease 2024, you have to be careful because it may not apply in your jurisdiction. So, you know, if you went to the, for example, California Apartment Association's website and found a lease that said California lease 2024, that's not going to work in San Francisco because of the local rent ordinance. And, you know, it's been around since the 1980s and it's, you know, got a lot of detail and there's been a lot of litigation about it. So the current, the local San Francisco Apartment Association, they rewrite their lease every year to catch it up.
Even the notices, the 3-day notices, or what I prepare, they vary from San Mateo, San Francisco, East Palo Alto, Mountain View, San Jose. You have to have certain language that the local ordinances require. So anyone who wants to make their own notice should be careful to follow those local laws.
We talked a little bit about no pet deposits. Can you still say, I don't want to rent to somebody with a pet?
So far, yes, you can. You cannot say no to service animals, service animals are protected under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and they are a dog or a pony, a small miniature horse, specifically, and they are task trained for something. It may be that that's expanded a bit, but all you can ask is that a service animal, and what is it trained to do specifically?
Who determines if it's a service animal? I know this working out in the community, an awful lot of people believe that their dog, cat, whatever the pet may be, is a service animal. Is there some standard somewhere about what a service animal is and is not?
Oh, yes. It's listed specifically in the Americans with Disabilities Act, which is a federal law.
So what we get a lot of calls about is emotional support animals.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The landlord apparently has a no pet policy, but then a week after they move in, you've got a letter from some sort of psychiatrist online that says, oh, so-and-so needs this animal because it's an emotional support animal.
Yeah. And the animal is like a Great Dane or something, you know, and
Great Dane that's teething.
That dog's coming in. That's what we pretty much advise is like, oh, they need an emotional support animal. That dog's coming in.
With an emotional support animal, you can put in house rules regarding that animal as far as like, if it's a dog, where are they allowed to go to the bathroom? Does the person have to clean up after it? You know, that sort of thing. If they bark too much, or, you know, if it's a parrot and it, you know, they squawk all night or something like that, you can put in rules about that.
Yeah. And those rules would be necessary for a number of reasons. One, to protect the quiet enjoyment of the other tenants. So when the landlord is, might seem to be picking on that particular tenant who has the emotional support animal, that's not necessarily true, because that animal could be bothering other tenants in the unit to which the landlord has an obligation to provide the quiet enjoyment. Do you believe, Jessica, that the statute covers emotional support animals, or that emotional support animals aren't worth fighting over because they'll probably be allowed?
Support animals are not ADA, Americans with Disabilities Act, service animals, unless they're specifically trained to perform a specific task. And they have to be, it has to be, I'm thinking of, usually service animals are for the blind, for people who have diabetes, and the animal can smell when their blood sugar changes and warn them before they have, a seizure or something. There are other people who have heart issues or blood pressure issues that, again, dogs have been trained to sense those. And those are task trained dogs that are considered service animals. They fall under the service animals because they are task trained to do something. Emotional support animals. In my 20 odd years of practicing, I've had some emotional support animals that were just angel animals, and some that were nightmares. They were barking or otherwise making a ton of noise, and part of the emotional support was to lift the owner from depression, but the depression made it impossible for the owner to clean up after a dog specifically, or something.
Yeah.
Or a cat. After a while, the litter box gets full and you got to deal with it,
Yeah, in some ways, most pets are going to provide emotional support to the owners. Most, you can keep animals as a hobby, I guess. Maybe that wouldn't provide the emotional support. But most animals, even if they're not ADA approved, cats, dogs, things like that, they are going to be, contribute to the emotional health of the owners. So we just find it difficult to deal with those as far as, you know, a basis for eviction. So we do, you know, impose rules and you know, ways that the animals have to be kept. And it usually works out okay, even though the landlord doesn't want the animal. I imagine now with the security deposit being, you know, 1 month, it's only going to make it worse, you know, as far as landlords not wanting these pets, which are then kind of brought in through the back door 1 or 2 months after the tenants move in the cases. You know, good cases don't come to my office. I always get the problem. And so that's the kind of fact pattern that comes into me. Like, you know, they moved in, and then 2 weeks later, they had a Rottweiler, you know, something like that. And
well, again, it depends on the Rottweiler. Some Rottweilers can be well-trained to, you know, not bark and to not mess in the house except for true accidents, you know, and that sort of thing, you know, and where they're not bothering them. See, that's the thing is I don't, my brother had a pit bull for a long time, and that dog was the best behaved dog I have ever met in my entire life, because my brother went to the effort of training him. Okay. You know, and, you know, I think that, I mean, all animals should be trained, because the ones that are pulling at the leashes or making a lot of noise or clawing at things, and, you know, and I'm not just talking about cats. Bearded dragons and other lizards can claw at sofas and things when they're not in their aquariums.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And I mentioned the Rottweilers just because they're big, you know, they're big. And so they're, you know, they're more to look at. And, you know, a small dog, a Chihuahua, I mean, they bark a lot, so they could annoy. If the animal is annoying other tenants, then, you know, they're going to become a basis for an eviction, most likely, if that behavior doesn't stop. But, you know, if you're talking about a non-ADA approved animal, you know, a big dog that's behaving properly, those are the tough ones, because, you know, there's nothing, there's no nuisance. So without the nuisance from the animal, it's just it's difficult to it's just difficult to you know, it's just difficult to deal with that situation. So rules are the best thing that we find that we can do for landlords or for tenants, you know, depends on who we're representing. But even for tenants, like, yeah, you want your big dog. It's usually the big dog that's the problem. You've got to make sure that it's quiet and well-behaved and that your apartment doesn't, you know, get messy. And
and that it interacts with others well, you know, it doesn't go charging after people on the street or, you know, in the hallways.
Yeah.
The problem I have regarding the nuisance is that the other co-tenants never want to come to court to testify as well. So it becomes an evidence problem.
Yeah.
Yes, everyone's complaining, but no one wants to come to court and testify against the problem owner.
Does anyone remember a case in San Francisco where a dog actually killed a tenant in a different apartment?
Oh, yes.
Anybody remember? Absolutely.
15 years ago?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Those were, I think it was two dogs, not one.
Cane Corso dogs,
those
yes.
Those were the ones, Jessica. It was the two of those dogs, and they attacked, I think it was a woman. I don't remember exactly, but anyway, those dogs killed the woman. The owners of the dogs went to jail. I don't know if anything happened to the landlord, but the tenants that owned those two dogs went to jail. I assume the dogs were put down. I don't remember, but that story was in the paper. And
that was in the paper for quite a while. The owner of the dogs was actually in the prison system, and those people were associated with him and actually took on his dogs, one of whom was present when the dog attacked the lady and killed her.
Yeah.
Horrific, horrific story.
Yeah, that I mean, that's a worst case scenario. That's not usually what we're dealing with when my office is dealing with a dog. It's usually just the presence of the dog that the landlord doesn't want, and you know, but for no other reason other than I don't want pets. And so, you know, I mean, aggressive animals it seems to be less common these days. Maybe for the past I don't know, 10 years, I've had less interactions with problems with an aggressive dog. It's usually just the dog. We don't want a dog. So anyway.
Yeah. I understand why landlords would want to have a pet-free or animal-free area. They do put extra wear and tear on things like carpets and flooring. I had one person who had, you know, a lot of rugs in her unit. And when her animal had accidents or whatever, she would clean it up. And she was, when she took the rugs out, she was thought everything was fine. But it was hardwood floors underneath, and some of the stuff had, you know, seeped in to the hardwood floors, and it wasn't. Hardwood floors are hard. You can't just always clean one spot. You have to get a person who knows what they're doing in to evaluate a hardwood floor. Sometimes, you know, and especially if you've got an old and weathered varnish on there, you know, as anything ages, it weathers a little bit. And so you can't always match the varnish that's there or the finish that's on the hardwood floor. And so I've had a couple of times where the tenant came and was upset because they got charged for the entire hardwood floor. Had landlords who were upset because, you know, the hardwood floor needed to be entirely refinished.
Yeah, that's tough. You know, that's tough. And, you know, with respect to the security deposit being 1 month now, and this, you know, an example like this with a hardwood floor issue, if a pet or even just a tenant ruins an apartment beyond that security deposit, the landlord will obviously be able to keep the security deposit as long as they can prove that the damage, and then they can still sue the tenant. They're not prohibited from suing, you know,
in small claims court,
additional damages. It's just that they won't have the money in advance. So their concern could be, well, I'm going to sue and get a judgment, but I wanted to have the money up front and avoid all that. So it's not like the legislature completely left the landlords in a lurch, so to speak, because they can still sue afterwards, and they can probably do it in small claims court, which means, you know, they can just do it themselves. So they're not even forced to hire a lawyer in most circumstances for these security deposit issues.
Right.
So, I mean, as horrible as it may seem to landlords, you know, it probably does seem horrible. They still have that avenue, which they had before. And so it didn't get taken away. You know, many times 1 month is not going to, you know, the 2 month security deposit isn't really that much better than the 1 month anyway, because they're still claiming more damages than that. And so, you know, they're going to fight over the security deposit anyway. So I, you know, not to sugarcoat it, but it's not that bad, you know, to make it easier for tenants to move in.
And that's why the legislature passed the amendment to Civil Code Section 1950.5 that goes into effect April 1 of next year, I believe, where the landlords have to document just before a new tenant moves in, not when the old tenant moves out, or they have to document both. You know, they have to have recent photos and things before a tenant moves in.
Yeah, interesting. They're being told what evidence to have, and I don't know if it's per se if they don't have it. Like, you know, is it now per se? Well, you don't have that. You didn't comply with the statute, so we're going to assume the unit is in the condition that it was when the tenant vacated it. It could end up being it's a great idea, but it may end up being a penalty, you know, to a landlord who doesn't know about, you know, they got to know this. And unless you know, unless they're listening to this program or getting information from a private attorney, or, you know, I don't know how else they're going to know.
Well, you know, there's the State Apartment Association. There are local apartment associations. There's the San Francisco Small Business Owners Association.
Yeah.
These are all disseminators of information. But the thing is, historically, 1950.5 has been a strict liability statute. You know, you either complied with it or you didn't, you know? And I think that it's going to continue being that way. If you don't comply with taking the pictures, then you're going to lose.
Yeah,
you know, that's always been a good idea. I mean, whether it was required by law or not, for both parties to take pictures on the way in and the way out, so there's not a lot of dispute, has always been really good advice. I've always followed it, although I haven't rented in a long, long time.
You know, and there are like checklists that you can download or that you can obtain from apartment associations or whatever that have, you know, things like, are there blinds? Are there curtains? Are there rugs? Was there a stove? And are these in good working order? Are there any windows broken? And, you know, the tenant and the landlord walk through when the tenant is taking over and everything is recorded. You know, if there's dents in walls or somebody punched a hole in a closet door, broke a mirror over the bathroom sink or, you know, whatever it is, record it. And you both have copies of it so you know that that broken mirror isn't the tenant's fault. It happened some other way.
Some other time.
Or that it is the tenant's fault when you're moving out and you're doing that checklist and you find a broken mirror.
A lot cheaper to take pictures than it does, you know, than it is to go to court. Hey, we have about a minute and a half left, and I wanted to ask where we are in terms of evicting nuisance tenants. There was a law, I remember, that was changing if somebody's had a law enforcement or contact or criminal conviction. Where do we stand on that now?
Well, Jeff, the way I'm handling nuisance evictions in San Francisco is they have to be, it can't be a one-time event. It usually has to be something that's happened more than once. And we'll usually send out a warning letter of our own, just, you know, knock it off. And if that doesn't work, then we'll back up the next one with an eviction notice. And I believe that under the rent ordinance, nuisances have to be, you know, severe and recurring. So that's why we're doing it that way, so that we have, you know, one warning letter for the nuisance and then an eviction notice.
Paul, do you find the same is true when you go other places? As a law, you know, if the police are called out to that place, is that sometimes fatal?
I'm with Sal. I don't let it just be one incident. There has to be at least two or three. And then I have to verify there will be witnesses who are willing to come to court, because without them, you know, we can't do anything.
So a minor incident probably doesn't do it, but a pattern will.
Exactly.
Sure. Unless, I mean, once or twice it's been a majorly big thing. Somebody went after another person with a knife. I think that counts for one.
I agree, Jessica.
That's one, two, or three. You've been listening to Your Legal Rights on KALW 91.7 FM, San Francisco Bay Area, where we've been focused on landlord-tenant law. Tonight's guests have been landlord-tenant attorneys extraordinaire Jessica Chalik and Salvatore Timpano of San Francisco and Paul Lee of San Mateo. Our final guest tonight has been all of you. Our show tonight's been produced by yours truly. Next week, Your Legal Rights will discuss what's new in labor and employment law. In 2 weeks, our election wrap-up. As always, we will take your calls and answer your questions. That's Your Legal Rights, Wednesdays at 6 p.m. A big thanks to tonight's guest and to all of you for listening. And for Joanne Marr at the controls tonight, Marla Davies. I'm Jeff Hayden. Good night, and zealously guard your legal rights.